Master Tabatami Tano Dan, you're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in north central Indiana, right next to Tabatami's Turtle Tavern, where the elite drink to eat, the first thing they drink. Also nearby is Tabatami's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, Insurgent, just plain old box holders. The old Tommy O'Kiss.
Yeah, you got it. That's right. It's Terrible Tommy, and it's time again. It is the fifth day of August, named after Augustus Caesar. How about that? Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Hey, let's get back to our pessimist guide to history here. Yeah, let's see what's going on here. And this one I like. 586 B.C., Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem. The kingdom of Judah had rebelled against Babylonian rule before. Let's see here. But ironically, the revolt was led by Zedekiah, the uncle of Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II. For 16 months, the city of Jerusalem in Judah withstood the siege of armies led by Nebuchadnezzar. But gradually, famine and pestilence began to ravage the rebels from within the city. On July 9th, the Babylonians finally breached the wall and stormed the city. Zedekiah and his troops escaped, but they were later captured and brought before Nebuchadnezzar. The soldiers, together with 80 or so citizens, were put to death before the vengeful king. But Zedekiah was not to get off so lightly. He was forced to watch his sons killed before his eyes and then have his eyes put out. The remaining population of Jerusalem, some 4,600 Jews, were rounded up and forcibly resettled into Babylon, thus beginning the Babylonian captivity. The soldiers looted and destroyed Jerusalem, knocking down the city's walls and setting fire to the temple, the palaces, the public buildings, just as at Nineveh, not too many years before, an army once again practiced no-holds-bar destruction. Then on 538 B.C., Babylon itself burns in a great fire. The magnificent Mesopotamian city of Babylon was leveled by fires that broke out after the Persian king Cyrus the Great conquered it in 538 B.C. Many of its citizens died in the conflagration, and the city's famed Hanging Gardens, one of the seven wonders of the world, were destroyed. Thus, Babylon in turn suffered defeat, and they say there's no justice. There you go, man. That's what happens. They go to war against you and break down your walls. Well, whoever built the last walls around Jerusalem, boy, I'll tell you, those were thick walls because I was there. And they were, man, those walls were thick. Boy, this wall war thing's been going on for a long, long time. Well, in the footsteps of Charlie Pride, I see we have a new Negro country singer being groomed, a female. Into Nashville, you know, they're going to push that. She's a high yellow mulatto, and they're going to push her right to the top. There goes country music. But country music hasn't been country music for a long time, except for a very few people. I call it New York country, or maybe Jerusalem country, or maybe Harlem country. You may get lucky. They're going to run the more Morton Downey Jr. shows that appeared back in the 80s out of New York City. They're going to be running those, I think, on the 17th of this month. But anyway, I know it's later in the month, so watch for it, because I did several shows with Morton Downey Jr. from the Apollo Theater in Harlem. And it's going to be interesting whether they put those on, because they were some really hot, good shows. If you didn't think white people had become nigrophiliacs, listen to this. This is about the Haitian sports team that came up to the United States, I believe it was, to compete, and forgot and lost their uniforms.
Stream before, and I think that that really gave people an energy that maybe they didn't have before.
I just want to hear about a few of the stories, if I can. I know there's a really feel-good story about spectators when it came to the soccer team from Haiti. Tell us about that.
So they were traveling, and there was a snafu with their luggage, and so they showed up and didn't have any uniforms. There was this lovely young woman named Mia who was in the audience that day when they were first taking the field, and she noticed that they didn't have uniforms, and she gathered a bunch of her friends and went to a local athletic store and started talking about this team from Haiti whose luggage had gotten lost. And it started to gain momentum. Customers in the store started being like, oh, I can give you money. Here, take $20, take $50. And then they went to another athletic store, and the store owner was like, no problem, let us help you. And they put together entire kits for this team so that the next time they took the field, they were in full uniform. She didn't know this team. She had never met anyone. But there is a camaraderie when you get here and a support that we are all in it together that is incredible, like nothing I've ever experienced before.
That's amazing. And Kate, we should say, you know, we think of the Special Olympics as different from the Olympics, but there are sometimes world records that are set in these games, right?
Well, there you go. And that was for the Special Olympics. Now, I don't know whether you've noticed, but they've been holding these Special Olympics worldwide, and I watched the big get-together in Europe, I'm not going to watch it very long, to where there's tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 people going to these Special Olympics. This is all part of a psychological downbreeding, or down something, or down syndrome, really, these retarded people and Down syndrome people are being put way out in front of normal people. They're being feted and bragged about and taken all over the world to these big meets. Somehow that doesn't quite get it with me. I just can't. I think you're trying to, you want to exhibit the best. And Special Olympics, to me, is a downer. I'm amazed at the amount of Down syndrome people are around here in the Midwest. There's some pretty bad breeding is going on here because they're abnormally present in the region where I'm at. I see them all the time. And as far as I'm concerned, that if they're able to determine a baby is going to be Down syndrome baby, they should take care of it before it's born, because essentially they become the ward of the state, or the parents become slaves to this person for decades. Well, let's tune in and see what Max Kaiser's doing today. How about it?
Kaiser Report, I'm Max Kaiser.
British broadcaster and naturalist Sir David Attenborough once said, there are some 4 million different kinds of animals and plants in the world, 4 million different solutions to the problems of staying alive. Here on Kaiser Report, we're about to offer you, over the course of the next 6 episodes, at least 6 different solutions to the problems of surviving our financial, economic, and monetary systems. Time now to turn to Dr. Guy Standing. He's the co-president of Basic Income Earth Network, and Stacey Herbert, of course. Stacey.
Hello. Okay. First, the problem we're going to present is what your book called the precariat, the new dangerous class. So who are the precariat, and why are they dangerous?
Well, basically, what we've seen is in the development of globalization, the opening of an international market system in which the world's labor supply has quadrupled in a couple of decades, putting huge downward pressure on the wages and working conditions of people in the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and so on. And in the process, what's happened is that the income inequalities have multiplied, as we all know. What has happened is that the share of national income going to capital has gone up by dramatic proportions. The share going to labor has gone down. And there's a class fragmentation that's taken place. Class hasn't disappeared. What we've got is a plutocracy. It's not the top 1%, it's the top 0.001%. And then you've got a salariat, people who have still got employment security, still got pensions, still got those sort of things, but they're shrinking. The old working class has disappeared, and you've got the precariat that's grown underneath, and an underclass, people outside in the streets dying from social illnesses.
So they call, like, precariat here, those would be people on zero-hour contracts.
Basically, there are three dimensions. The first dimension is that unstable labor. They are expected to internalize a life of unstable labor without having an occupational identity or career. Mm. That's the first feature. The second feature is they have to rely very much on money wages. No benefits, no rights as such. And this is going with increasing economic uncertainty, so that they're always on the edge of unsustainable debt. Millions and millions of people are in the precariat. It's growing very rapidly. The new things like Uber, the so-called sharing economy, and the growth of crowd labor and these sort of things are merely multiplying the ways by which people are entering the precariat. And we're seeing it in various ways. Some people glamorize it and talk about people being self-entrepreneurs and all these wonderful things. But the reality is that for millions of people, they're facing a life of increasing insecurity amidst growing inequality that shows no signs of stopping.
Right, so, but this is along geographical lines. Now, in the U.S. or the U.K., you have the precariat. These are folks that are downwardly mobile. They're competing with the Chinese who only know the precariat, but they're making a move out of the off the farms and into what they perceive to be an increase in life standards, et cetera. So it does break along those geographical lines, right?
No. I've just come from speaking to a group of Chinese chief executives and junior ministers of government, as it happens. And there in China, in Chinese cities, you have the largest number in the world who are in the precariat.
But are they calling it the precarious? Do they consider themselves precarious or lucky to be off the farm?
My book is just coming out in Mandarin, and they have various euphemisms and names for it. But the precariat in cities of China, India, and various other parts of developing countries are huge now. And one feature of them is that they have a level of education that is greater than the level of labor they're expected to do. They call one of these types in China, they call it the ant tribe. The ant, simply because people are rushing around, they don't have homes, they don't have stability. So I think that part of the impetus for the growth of the precariat is coming from what's happening in China, paradoxically. Because this quadrupling of labor supply that I talked about has come from China and India and Indonesia and so on, which has put all these downward pressure on wages. In China itself, real wages are beginning to rise. We know that. But the inequalities have grown more in China than in any other part of the world. And that's one of the paradoxes of this period.
Right, because their real wages, on balance, are rising in China.
But
whereas in the U.S. and the U.K.,
they're collapsing.
Right.
Real wages have declined in the United States by a huge amount, while productivity has gone up. That's one of the ironies. But one shouldn't romanticize what's happening or glamorize what's happening in China, because much of the insecurity has come because money wages have gone up, but they've lost a lot of entitlements and forms of social protection that existed under the Danwei, what was called the Danwei system, which provided from cradle to grave a sense of the iron rice bowl.
Yeah, in effect.
So you've basically got a disguised change in their living standards. Yes, their money wages have gone up, but they're losing a lot of other things that were the alternative to it. I don't want to say which is better. I'm merely saying that this is a huge change.
You mentioned also that they're overeducated for the work they're doing, but we see that in America too. You hear often of PhDs or master's degrees working at McDonald's and Walmart. But one of the people keep on saying, oh, well, we at least have Uber now. You can rent out your car. You know, you could become a driver to make some money, or Airbnb and rent out your apartment. But with Uber, Uber's already getting ready to hire driverless cars, to buy driverless cars. You were just in Silicon Valley. What was your experience there? You actually spoke to a robot who had a conversation with you about the precarious.
That's right. Look, I think one has to see what is happening with Uber and all of these other crowd labor apps as the new rentiers, the new labor brokers. Must remember that when Uber deals with a driver, they make 20% on each task done. It's the same with all of these things.
TaskRabbit,
Elance, and all of these others are making phenomenal amounts of money by extracting rent. Okay, and actually, what they're doing is holding down the wage rates and lowering the wage rates of other professions and occupations that they are effectively displacing. Now, I know that Hillary Clinton has given a speech recently, and Jeb Bush has given a Republican variant of the same speech, but I think that one is seeing is that, yes, this is a new form of labor. We are in a world now that in the next 10 years, one in every three labor transactions will be done online with Dutch auction type situations where you announce on Monday, you know, we have so many tasks that need to be done. We will start at $20 an hour, and Friday lunchtime we will close the Dutch auction, and whichever is the lowest bid will take.
Well, right down behind us is the Shed Thames, and you see the architecture from the warehouses on the Thames River, and every 6 hours they had an auction for labor.
Sure.
You're returning to those days.
It's a global sense.
Okay, so why did organized labor fail?
I mean, partly because in a globalized system, you have a huge labor surplus situation, so you can move production and employment increasing with the new technologies. So a typical big corporation will have 40 different plants in 40 different countries, and if you push up wages in one, they'll say we'll shift at the margins to somewhere else. And it's weakened the bargaining position.
Yeah, but the term organized labor, there's the word organized. So they see these changes coming. But they are not organized enough to deal with them. I mean, there's a failure, I think, beyond just macro.
As I've discussed in the books, the unions, the labor unions, mm-hmm. were the 20th century answer, or a part of the answer, to industrial capitalism.
Right, they have not.
But now they cannot be that model.
They don't have an answer for what's going on now.
Correct.
They're not organized in that sense. So now here in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, who just won the labor representation for the government here.
Well, he hasn't won it yet.
Well, okay, he's not in the process. Good. Okay, stand corrected. But his rhetoric, though, is from the 20th century.
Exactly.
So he's not organized enough. He's not reading books like this, The Precariat, by Guy Standing. Precariat, in France, of course, this word precarious is one that, when I first heard this, they refer to their youth as the precarious generation, that they are without any social net at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're saying that. But what about a country like, anyway, let me finish my point. So Jeremy Corbyn is completely deficient, intellectually speaking, to address this problem, because he's trying to pull out from the tool bag solutions from 100 years ago.
I think one should be a little bit more generous. Wait, if you let me finish.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Please, Guy, continue.
A little bit more generous to what I think he is trying to do. Basically, he is saying the new labor, the answer, is wrong. He's going back to roots. I also agree with you that I think his answers are wrong. But he is he's focusing in on this growing inequality, the growing moralistic nature of modern politics, which is dividing hard-working
Wait,
people.
He's just wagging his finger, though, saying, we need more morality. That's not a solution.
I agree with you.
He should become a poet or a painter in the street, but not a political leader.
I don't want to waste our limited time on this.
We have all the time in the world. It's my show, guy. We can do more. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a whole second half in just a few seconds. What's coming up in the second half? Because we're going to cut to the second half.
I think you're wise to do that.
Yeah, we're going to do that.
We're going to talk about basic income. You've also written a book about that called...
Yes.
Oh, basic income, a transformative policy for India, you were talking about in particular, and the continuing automation, because we're talking about these workers that are precarious, but many of these precariats are actually going to be, they're going to even lose those jobs at Walmart or serving food or doing Uber jobs.
All right, we're going to cover that in the second half. We're going to pause for break, and we'll be back right after this break.
Well, I hope you're soaking this all up, because there's a lot of information here on what's going on worldwide, to where the so-called leaders of labor have no power to straighten these people out. I mean, predatory capitalism is so much in power that they could transfer their manufacturing anywhere in the world. And everywhere they're doing it, the people are ending up at the little end of the stick. And this is going to get worse and worse and worse. It's returning the entire population of the earth to the times of peasantry, like in the Middle Ages or something like that. So I'm going to play the second half of this show.
To the Kaiser Report, I'm Max Kaiser. I'm here with Stacey Herbert with Summer Solutions, episode regarding jobs and basic income. Let's return to Dr. Guy Standing. He's the co-president of Basic Income Earth Network. Dr. Standing, welcome back to the show. We're going to, Stacey?
I have a headline, and I want to discuss this in relation to the precariat and a possible basic income as a possible solution, one of many possible solutions, I'm sure. The robots are here, and you should be worried. During a presentation at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs this week, which was back in June, researcher Wendell Wallach said technology is now destroying more jobs than it creates. He said, quote, "This is an unparalleled situation and one that I think could actually lead to all sorts of disruptions once the public starts to catch on that we are truly in the midst of a technological unemployment." What do you think of this? Do you think it's real? Do you think it's a danger? And how do you move forward?
Look, I think this thesis has been around since at least the Luddites of the early 19th century. And, of course, we have more jobs now than at any time in human history.
But are a lot of those fake?
No. I think we must realize that there is more work that's being done that doesn't get counted as jobs. And we need really to rethink what it is we mean by work. I think there's a fantastic amount of potential work that could be done. A lot of work is done by the precariat that doesn't get counted as work, and so on. A lot of care work that is done that doesn't get counted as treated as irrelevant, but we need to do it. We have unmet needs in every part of the world. I work a lot of the time in developing countries. There is so much to be done to raise living standards, to improve healthcare, to improve education, to improve infrastructure. So to think that work per se is disappearing is a bit fanciful. I mean, it really is a bit simplistic. What I do think is happening, of course, is that the pace of technological change and the electronics and all of that is destroying many traditional jobs. Industrial jobs, even service jobs, many forms of traditional jobs are being destroyed or being dislocated. So that we're having a real challenge. And what's happening is that the technology is increasing the inequalities. Because if you're a patent holder today, you're making vast sums of money, and there are millions of people who have patents. Whereas if you're a person who relies on work for your income, you're in real trouble, more trouble than ever. That's why I agree with your point about Corbyn going back to the 20th century, because that's wrong. Our income distribution system has broken down.
And okay, but that's the question is, on basic income. This is different than jobs, loss of jobs. This is a concept that's been floating now, and it's popular. Switzerland, I think, had a referendum recently about this. So did you want to talk a little bit about what does that mean?
What's happened, I've been promoting basic income for 30 years, and we have an international network. Anybody can join, and thousands are doing so. And the idea of a basic income stems from two things. One, a matter of justice, saying that we all deserve to be sharing in the wealth of society. That's one argument. And the second is that you cannot devise an alternative way of reducing the inequality and giving people, ordinary workers, basic security unless you have a basic income. What does it mean? Okay? A basic income would mean that every man, every woman, and every child in any society would receive a monthly, unconditional basic income. Wouldn't be very much to start with. It would be, say, half what you need for a decent subsistence. And then you would build it up. It's happening in a few countries. We've done pilots in India, in Namibia, and in Brazil, where people are provided with a basic income. Now, the arguments against a basic income traditionally is that, first of all, it's unaffordable. That's the classic argument. That is complete nonsense. When you have governments able to go for quantitative easing, as we have the European Central Bank now, a thousand billion euros going into the financial market, don't tell me we can't afford it.
The bankers are on a basic income.
Bankers have a basic income.
It's called quantitative easing.
Exactly.
But let me ask you a question.
Let me just finish that answer. Yes. Whereas we at the moment provide huge subsidies to the middle class, to corporations, and so on, and we have a very dysfunctional, means-tested social security system, the scope for shifting expenditures is dramatic. So the affordability argument is wrong. The second classic argument against a basic income is that somehow if you gave people a basic income, they'd become lazy and all go lounging around, right? That is an insult to the human condition. None of us, or maybe 99% of us, don't want just the minimum. We want to improve the lives of our children, our friends, ourselves, and so on. And with our experiments, and we've done big-scale experiments in India, for example, where we provided thousands of people with a basic income, was that one of the biggest effects was that people start to work more, not less. And when they work, they're more productive, not less. And when they work, they're more tolerant of others and they're more cooperative with their communities. And in fact, they find different forms of work to do, like improving sanitation, improving one's community, improving the infrastructure. So traditional jobs may not be boosted by a basic income.
But they do things.
Exactly.
Demonetizing stress.
Exactly. That's a very important part of it.
Friedrich Hayek himself actually also argued on a free market thing that as a free market solution for a basic income, it does make the wage, you know, in a negotiation between an employee and an employer, it allows it to be more honest because
I don't often agree with Friedrich, but on this particular point,
let's jump in for a second though, because let's take what about an accurate, true accounting for so-called externalities in an economy. For example, an energy company, large energy company, they do not account for the ecological problems they create. So let's say to break it down even more on a retail level, if somebody is driving a gas-guzzling car and burning up huge amounts of fuel and therefore causing this ecological cost, and somebody has a bicycle, I mean, can't you find a point within the market that says you're going to shift some of that cost, let's say vis-a-vis an increased levy, to account for their actual cost of the environmental damage, and this person who is not causing that environmental damage should get a commensurate income.
I think moving towards a basic income would strengthen the ecological arguments. One of the problems we've faced in advocating a basic income is from the unions often saying, no, we must go for job creation and not worry about these externalities that you're talking about. It would reduce the need to focus on phony job creation, because basically you can say, look, you have your basic income and you can reorient your life. And one of the great advantages of a basic income is that it would shift people from labor to doing more work, reproductive work in terms of caring for our communities, our neighbors, our frail relatives, and so on. And it would enable people to say no to really exploitative jobs.
So this notion of basic income has been around for a long time,
sure,
but it's only becoming quite mainstream now, and part of it is because of these driverless trucks now on the road being tested in America. And this has only happened in the last few months. But here's a chart of the most common job for each state in the United States. And you see that color, that's truck driver. So that's the number one job. That's one of the last remaining pretty well-paying jobs for a guy with no college education. That's going to be displaced. So people are actually asking, like Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, actually responded to a question on Facebook. She was asked about a basic income because of all these rapid technological changes. And I'll just read the first sentence or two. She said, I had a feeling this might come up. You are asking exactly the kind of questions that we all need to be asking about the future of work in an age of accelerating technological change. I certainly don't have the answers, but we have to resolve these questions while embracing the promise and potential of these new technologies and without stifling innovation or limiting the ability, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, this is now Americans are actually talking about it, who are often against these sort of concepts, but it's now becoming a sort of practical reality. How would they finance it? How would that actually happen in the United States? What would it look like?
I've just recently been in Washington, D.C., where I was talking to a very big conference about this. And I would say to the Americans who are running for president and running for office that one of the things they should commit to doing is setting up a national commission to look into how it could be done and what ways of financing it. But in addition to that, I think what they should do is launch some pilots in sort of selected areas to see on the feasibility, to see on the, again, returning to this issue of externalities. One of the externalities that we find from having a basic income is that it improves mental and physical health.
And that's a big problem in the U.S.
Of course,
you see it with a huge drug problem there across many.
And if you improve health, you obviously lower the demands on your public health care system and lower the costs. It's the same with schooling and education. We find that if people who have basic security, their children are more likely to take good advantage of schools, which means that the public school systems can be more efficient and you lower costs. So you've got to look at the indirect positive effects.
They did a study up in Oregon, I think it was, where they gave free health care. This was before Obamacare, free health care to a community. And what they noticed most was the reduction in mental stress, in like emotional stress.
Yeah, and I think that one of the great things we've found as far as health's concerned is that if you give an individual a basic income, they can decide on which aspects of their health care that they think should be given priority. And one of those, this is why on the front cover of the book, there's a picture of a woman. Now, that woman has no legs. And before we launched the basic income, she was always the last to get the food, the last to get any health treatment. But as a result of her having her basic income, she was able to save up with the help of her family and now has a beautiful sari, bought a sewing machine, and has become a productive member of the community. That sort of social effect really needs to be considered.
Well, as the Beatles said, all you need is love. And that's basic income. All right, well, Guy Standing, thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report. We're out of time. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a great pleasure.
And that's going to do it for this.
I find it quite interesting that back in the Depression, there was a man by the name of Townsend. He started a movement among the poor and the working class that became tremendously important and popular. and he would fly around California where he lived and give speeches to thousands of people. And his recommendation to Washington was, here we are in this depression, let's give all these people $10 every Friday, which now seems like nothing, but $10 in the depression was a lot of money. And his logic was that they would take that $10 and spend it into the economy, which in most cases they're not going to sit on it, they're going to spend it. And that's exactly what this fellow is saying internationally. But you see, the problem is the ruling class will not allow it. The ruling class and the predatory capitalists will harpoon it every time. Actually, quite a few of Townsend's ideas were absorbed into the Democratic Party during the Roosevelt administration. I know what most guys are going to say, oh, that Roosevelt, because most of the time they're talking about the war. But there were some good things that did happen in the Roosevelt administration, because there certainly would have been a revolution in this country if something hadn't been done. Of course, starting a war, worldwide war, is not the best way to do it, but there were other programs that were used to try and stave off this revolution. In other words, I think there's a book around that said that Roosevelt saved capitalism. And that's what everybody keeps saying. He was a socialist type, but he saved capitalism. Capitalism was on the ropes, and the country was headed towards a revolution. But anyhow, Townsend, there's a book, I've got it in my library, I forget the title, but I can dig it out for you, and when I do, I'll give it to you, which he had some really great ideas in the depth of the Depression. But the one problem, or one of the problems that this fellow and Max are not talking about, is overpopulation. That no plan can work with runaway population, because it's like going to the beach and digging a hole in the sand, and all of a sudden the water fills up the hole and the sand caves back in. There has to be a worldwide brakes put on the birth rate, especially in these other countries. But see how we're screwing up. We could have done a great job here in this country if we'd have started in the 50s and cut off immigration into the country, especially of non-whites. We could have done that and kept the population at a reasonable figure. But we started putting under the white birth rate. We stopped the white birth rate. Now, Margaret Sanger, who was the forerunner of the present program that's under attack in Washington, she was trying to, not necessarily to limit the population, but she was trying to improve the population among the white race. She was a great, really great female racist. I've got a big sign out in front of my house. I support Margaret Sanger, and you should study about her, you know. But all these Christians are going after her programs and ideas about birth control is an evil thing. Well, birth control is not an evil thing. In the wild, it happens naturally among animals to keep the number of animals down to where they don't overrun their food supply and living area. And I keep telling these people, I said, you know, all these Christians that are saying, oh, how horrible abortion is, well, then there should be the ruling class should develop a pot of money and tax all these people and tax the churches, so that if you want to keep a unwanted child alive, that you have to put into this fund that will feed and educate that child until he's, say, 21. But that they don't want to do. They want to save every living being to go directly into poverty or being used as soldiers in the war to kill other people and kill themselves. And this is one of the most ridiculous positions of the Republican Party, and I think a lot of them know it, that without some kind of subsistence to educate and feed all these children that you save from abortion, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And so anyhow, that's another way of looking at it. Now, people will say, oh my God, they're aborting a lot of white kids. Well, yeah, but not compared to the percentage per capita of non-whites. To where the Christians, they're not discerning we should not abort white kids. They're to the point where they say we should not abort any kids, and no matter, even birth defective kids. So they have no answer at all. Well, the answer, yeah, they have an answer. It's tragedy and worse situation for the population. Plus, there's a lot of white mothers that should not have kids. They're just not capable. They may be into drugs. They may be alcoholics. You name it. And for them to have kids is a tragedy. But the bigger problem, like I say, is that overpopulation around the world, and something has to be done, because no economic policy will work with runaway birth rates. Humanity's all destined to be, you know, just slaves and living in the gutter. So, anyhow, that's Tommy's position. Maybe I didn't put it out there as well as some might, but I think you get the message. And when they say, well, war will answer this problem, it'll kill off more and more and more people. Well, it didn't in World War I or II. I mean, millions of people died. 55 million people died in World War II, and about the same amount died in World War I. And Lloyd George in England and the boys sit around their coffee table before World War I started and said, well, if this war starts, it will limit the population and bring it under control. But did it? No, it didn't. It increased poverty all over the place, but it didn't bring the birth rate under control. So you can't believe in mechanized warfare is going to bring the population under control. It's not going to happen. Plus, they don't want to talk about who is best to save. The white race, the brown race, the red race, the yellow race. Well, you and I think it's the white race, but the other colors think it's theirs to do, too. So that immediately brings you to international warfare, racial warfare. It's going to boil down to race. There's no doubt about that. Don't worry. Racism is far from dead. It's growing. Just that the only people that are being called racist are whites. And racism is normal. Tribalism is normal. And so these other races don't want to admit they're racist. But there's far more racism among these underdeveloped countries than in the United States. Do you guys like movie trivia? Well, remember the film Fight Club with Norton and Brad Pitt? I'm going to read you a little trivia from that film, making of that film. After the copyright warning, there is another warning on the DVD. This warning is from Tyler Durden and is only there for a second. Quote, if you're reading this, then this warning is for you. Every word you read of this is useless. Fine print is another second off your life. Don't you have other things to do? Is your life so empty that you honestly can't think of a better way to spend these moments? Or are you so impressed with authority that you give respect and credence to all those who claim it? Do you read everything you're supposed to read? Do you think everything you're supposed to think? Buy what you're told you should want? Get out of your apartment. Meet a member of the opposite sex. Stop the excessive shopping and masturbation. Quit your job. Start a fight. Prove you're alive. If you don't claim your humanity, you will become a statistic. You have been warned. Tyler, unquote. Now remember, we're talking about Fight Club, the movie. When a Fight Club member sprays the priest with a hose, the camera briefly shakes in this film. This happens because the cameraman couldn't keep himself from laughing. In a short scene when Brad Pitt and Edward Norton are drunk and hitting golf balls, they really are drunk, and the golf balls are sailing directly into the side of the catering truck. When Tyler, who is played by Brad Pitt, catches the narrator, Ed Norton, listening at the door as he has sex with Marla, who's Helena Bonham Carter, he's wearing a rubber glove. This was Brad Pitt's idea and caused a great deal of controversy with the president of the production at Fox 2000 Pictures, Laura Ziskin. She was horrified when she saw the scene and demanded that it be removed. However, at a subsequent test screening, the appearance of the glove got the biggest laugh of the whole movie, prompting Ziskin to change her mind. Brad Pitt says he didn't want his parents to see the movie, but he couldn't convince them not to watch. They changed their minds after watching the chemical burn scene. Author Chuck Palahniuk first came up with the idea for the novel after being beaten up on a camping trip when he complained to some nearby campers about the noise of their radio. When he returned to work, he was fascinated to find that nobody would mention or acknowledge his injuries, instead saying such commonplace things as, "How was your weekend?" Palahniuk concluded that the reason people reacted this way was because if they asked him what had happened, a degree of personal interaction would be necessary, and his workmates simply didn't care enough to connect with him on any personal level. It was his fascination with his societal blocking which became the foundation of this novel. Chuck Palahniuk has stated that he found the film Fight Club to be an improvement on his novel. When the narrator hits Tyler Durden in the ear, Edward Norton actually did hit Brad Pitt in the ear. He was originally going to fake hit him, but before the scene, David Fincher pulled Norton aside and told him to hit him in the ear. After Norton hit him in the scene, you can see him smiling and laughing while Pitt is in real pain. During the shooting of the film, Helena Bonham Carter insisted that her makeup artist, Julie Pierce, apply all of her eye makeup with her left hand because Bonham Carter felt that Marta was not a person who would be particularly skilled at or concerned with correctly applying makeup. To prepare for their roles, Edward Norton and Brad Pitt took basic lessons in boxing, taekwondo, and grappling, and also studied hours of UFC programming prior to principal photography. Pitt also visited a dentist to have his front tooth chipped. In the scene where Tyler is giving an inspirational speech to Fight Club members, he says, "We've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars." Right as he says rock star, he looks specifically at Jared Leto's character. Jared Leto formed the band 30 Seconds to Mars in 1998. Their last album went platinum. The original Pillow Talk scene had Marta saying, "I want to have your abortion," when this was objected to by Fox 2000 Pictures president of production Laura Ziskin. David Fincher said he would change it on the proviso that the new line couldn't be cut. Zislin agreed, and Fincher wrote the replacement line, quote, "I haven't been fucked like that since grade school." When Ziskin saw the new line, she was even more outraged and asked for the original line to be put back. But, as per their deal, Fincher refused. In the infamous incident, the Friday that the film was released theatrically in the United States, Rosie O'Donnell appeared on her TV show and revealed that she had seen the film earlier in the week and had been unable to sleep ever since. She then proceeded to give away the twist ending of the film and urged all of her viewers to avoid the movie at all costs. Edward Norton, Brad Pitt, and David Fincher discussed the incident on their DVD commentary track, with Pitt calling O'Donnell's actions unforgivable. This was a very popular film among the skinheads, I'll tell you that. And a lot of my friends. David Fincher took 12 takes of the stuntman rolling down the stairs for the fight between the narrator and Tyler at the end of the film. The take used in the movie is the very first one. The scene where the narrator's boss, Zach Grenier, finds the rules of Fight Club in the photocopier, and the narrator points out that whoever wrote it is obviously dangerous and might one day storm through the building shouting to everyone, proved to be highly controversial scene for the filmmakers. In early test screenings, the scene got huge laughs and scored extremely highly with audiences. However, these screenings appeared before the Columbine massacre. In all the screenings after Columbine, the scene evoked no laughter whatsoever and scored extremely poorly, with the audience commenting that they felt it was in bad taste. This prompted the studio to ask the director, David Fincher, to cut the scene altogether. Fincher considered doing this, because the scene leads into the pivotal Marla breast cancer scene, he decided it couldn't be cut. In the scene where the narrator is sitting on a toilet and with his pants down while reading an IKEA catalog, Edward Norton is actually completely nude from the waist down. Norton talks about it on the DVD commentary, to which David Fincher says, "Really?" Norton then says, "Did you notice I never had to go to the bathroom that day?" Brad Pitt and Helena Bonham Carter spent 3 days recording orgasmic sounds for their unseen sex scenes. Tyler Durden, Brad Pitt, was originally going to recite a workable recipe for homemade explosives, as he does in the novel. But in the interest of public safety, the filmmakers decided to substitute fictional recipes for the real ones. So if you're going to make a bomb, don't follow their instructions. David Fincher claimed to in an interview in the UK film magazine Empire that there is a Starbucks coffee cup visible in every shot in the movie. The visible breath in the cave scene is recycled Leonardo DiCaprio breath from the Titanic, which was a composited into the shot. Starbucks pulled their name from the coffee shop destruction scene. They didn't mind that the director placed their product throughout the film, but did not want their name to be destroyed in that scene. Therefore, the Gold Globe crashes into a shop named Gratifico Coffee. In the scene where the narrator is popping a mint into his mouth, a promotional video of the Bridgeworth Suites is playing on the television. You can see that one of the hotel employees in the commercial is Brad Pitt. He is the one to the right of the TV screen. This goes on for quite a while. If you really want it, I'll send it to you. But it's a little interesting in the making of the film Fight Club, which was, I consider it a very, very good film. Anyhow, you can find the rest of this long article about the film on Amazon, Prime Start Video, but it's labeled IMDb, whatever that means. I'm not sure whether this story is from Australia or England. It says a white supremacist responsible for the murder of two men in Bear Cove Park will continue to serve the remainder of his life in prison. On Monday, the state's appeals court rejected an appeal from James Winquist, formerly from Hingham, who was convicted of the 2005 second-degree murder of William Capon and David Lyon. In his appeal, Winquist argued that a key witness should not have been allowed to testify, and statements from a co-defendant, Eric Snow, who committed suicide in jail 6 months before the trial, should not have been admitted as evidence. The state's highest court rejected both arguments. In 2005, Winquist and Snow beat Chaffron and Lyon to death and placed their bodies in an abandoned bunker in Bear Cove Park. The two, who were part of a small neo-Nazi group called the Brotherhood of Blood, killed the men as part of an initiation into the group. Interesting. Or not. And we'll close with this one. Lithuania's hunt for Jewish war criminals, finally, who fought the Nazis. In 1998, Lithuania established a commission to investigate local collaboration with the Soviet Union and Germany, who successfully occupied the country during World War II. But rather than searching out the numerous Lithuanians who aided the SS in the murdering of Jews, the commission turned against one of its own participants. Now, this is from a Jewish source, so take that into consideration. The eminent Israeli Holocaust historian, Yazik Arad, who fought the Germans as part of a pro-Soviet partisan unit. Daniel Brook writes, on April 22, 2006, Republika, an openly anti-Jew newspaper that is one of Lithuania's highest circulated dailies, published a story headlined, quote, the expert with blood on his hands, unquote. The article used passages of Arad's memoir, The Partisan, published in English in 1979, to criticize him. In the Republika article, what Arad's memoir terms a 1944 mopping up operation against the armed Lithuanians after the German withdrawal becomes an ethnic cleansing of Lithuanians that was part of a larger Soviet genocide. Arad, who was a teenager during the Holocaust period, is referred to as an NKVD stormtrooper. The anti-communist convictions that are evident throughout Arad's book, his recounting of how Stalin crushed the organized Jewish community of Lithuania during the annexation of 1940, and his description of his hometown's market turned scraggly and abandoned in the fallout from the disastrous communist economic policies, go unmentioned as for the defection of this supposedly rabid communist from Soviet Lithuania. The article seems genuinely puzzled. Quote, it is not evident why, but right after the war, why Arad decided to run to the West. And I guess he's was living in Europe. I'm not sure whether he's alive or not, but it's time. It's what I've been saying for a long time. They got to go after the Jew war criminals that fought on the side of the Russians or whatever. There's plenty of them around, and they're still alive. But this is a good start. Looks like the Lithuanians at least are talking about it. That article appeared in the Mosaic, which is a Jewish magazine, a web magazine, M-O-S-A-I-C. which, believe it or not, there's a lot of good information comes through out of the mouths of the Jews themselves. Now, this has been talked about by a number of people lately, and even the Jews are talking about it. To this day, no pulpit talk by a contemporary American rabbi has generated greater attention or controversy than a sermon delivered by Rabbi David Wolpe on the morning of Passover 2001. The truth, Rabbi Wolpe informed his Los Angeles congregation, is that the way the Bible describes the Exodus from Egypt is not the way it happened, if it happened at all. Beyond dropping a theological bombshell, the sermon ushered in a new era, one in which synagogue-attending Jews could increasingly expect to be confronted with the findings of academic study of the Bible. To Rabbi Wolpe, intellectual honesty mandated that, with respect to the Exodus in particular, these findings be not only confronted, but embraced, and it was the duty of spiritual leaders like himself to help the faithful assimilate them. You're going to find out that a great amount of these things they talk about in the Old Testament and the New Testament, of course, never happen. They're created out of whole cloth. In the intervening years, thanks no small part to the internet and ubiquity of social media, exposure of these findings has increased exponential. Much of it's focused on one issue, the historicity, or especially the non-historicity, of biblical Exodus. In, for example, an inaugural essay for thetorah.com, a website devoted to integrating the study of the Torah with the disciplines and findings of academic biblical scholarship, Rabbi Zev Farber declared categorically that given the data to which modern historians have access, it is impossible to regard the accounts of mass exodus from Egypt or the wilderness experiences historical at all. Now, you can go to this magazine online, like I told you, Mosaic. They have a lot of very interesting stuff in it, and if you think the Jews don't expose a lot of the crap that other Jews put out, well, you go there and you'll find out. That's about it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. And remember, always, five words. It may save your life. And stick to it, no matter how they threaten you.